Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. It's Bill Bartholomew here with you for a special edition of the pod today, a live taping that we did earlier this week at the Brenton Hotel in Newport with Homicide at Rough Point author and investigative journalist Peter Lance. Now, many of you may remember Peter from two previous episodes we've done in the last year following his blockbuster investigative research that really blew the lid off of the fable surrounding Doris Duke and what Peter proves to be the murder of her longtime companion and sort of advisor, Eduardo Tarilla. And if you think back to the previous episodes, if you haven't had a chance to listen to them, we'll give you a little bit of a summary of this entire story here in today's episode. But basically, in Newport, Doris Duke, a tobacco heiress, a zillionaire, she owned Rough Point, one of the large mansions on Bellevue Avenue, right where it turns to Ocean Drive. And there was an incident that took place that was categorized as an unfortunate accident. And basically, Doris Duke, using her vast wealth, her fabulous wealth, as Peter Lance describes, was able to buy her way out of a murder charge. And we get into all the details here in today's conversation. You can also find them in the previous two episodes I just referenced. And of course, check out Peter's book, Homicide at Rough Point, which is blowing up on the Amazon charts, so on and so forth, and also a Vanity Fair article he wrote on this matter in last summer's, I think it's the July-August issue. You can find it right there. But this is a story we've been covering for about a year now here on B-Town, and it's just been unbelievable the response we've gotten on a national basis to the conversations that I've had with Peter. So Peter Lance, based in Los Angeles, he's out in Newport post-pandemic this July, gathering more and more research, and we're going to break some news here in this conversation that you're about to hear, including new witnesses, people who were around this event on the night that it took place, including a gentleman, 93-year-old Ernest Gibbons, whose voice you'll actually hear in the episode coming up. So this is great stuff. We had a great crowd, tons of energy at the beautiful Brenton Hotel right on America's Cup Avenue in Newport. And this was sort of a last-minute thing that Peter was in town. We had been talking about doing a third installment of our conversations, and he was in town and said, hey, let's do this, and let's do it in the hotel, live in front of an audience, see if we can get something going. On a day's notice, we were able to put it together and, again, get a great crowd and appreciate everyone who came out the night. We're going to do more of these B-Town Live things, both here at the Loft and all around the state. It's been on my mind even pre-pandemic. This is sort of the first installment of that. So I hope you enjoy, and hopefully you can feel some of the energy in the room that we had while we were doing this live conversation. If you'd like to support the independent journalism, entertainment, analysis, and opinion that we provide here on B-Town, well, there's a few ways you may do so. You can send a one-time donation to Venmo at Bill Bartholomew, paypal.me/BillBartholomew, or become a sustaining member for as little as $3 per month by visiting patreon.com/BartholomewTown. Appreciate everyone who has already done that. Your support goes right into the bedrock, the foundation of this show. There's a lot of fees associated with it, you know, in terms of web hosting, so on and so forth. Patreon.com/BartholomewTown. It really helps the cause. Okay, without further ado, to the Brenton Hotel in Newport, Rhode Island, my third conversation here in less than a year with Peter Lance, Homicide at Rough Point. B-Town. All right, so thanks everybody for being here today. We're at the beautiful Brenton Hotel here in the heart of Newport, and what better place to do a live podcast with Peter Lance. This will be the third time we've had a conversation in less than a year on your incredible investigative work with respect to the Doris Duke, Edward Tarillo incident, and of course your book, Homicide at Rough Point. It's blowing up the charts on Amazon. You've got the piece in Vanity Fair, all the accolades, but the teeth of it, the meat of it, is really moving minds and shaping opinion in something that has been for decades sort of a fable around Newport. So Thanks for doing this. It was your idea to do it.
I'm thrilled. Yeah, I proposed it because
the two earlier podcasts
were just so well received, and Christian Withrow put it in the buzz, which I'm always hoping he'll do with this one too eventually. So, who I have great respect for. He was on to this Doris Duke Torella story, Christian Withrow, very early on, like around 2015, he did a piece on it. So he's kind of a pioneer. But anyway, I'm thrilled to be here, and there are a number of my friends, and some key sources in the book are here that I've never even physically met, including a woman named Denise Clement. A new source to me is Ernest Gibbons from this legendary Newport family, 93 years young, who has a fabulous story to tell relating to this. He and I just got to know each other over the weekend, and without further ado, let's let it rip.
I guess let's start with sort of just the Reader's Digest version of the story itself. This is sort of a recap for the listeners who have already read the book and have heard the podcast, but just sort of take us through in a nutshell, what this is all about.
Okay, so Doris Duke was the richest woman in America in 1966. She had inherited three fortunes, American Tobacco Company, which created Lucky Strike, the modern cigarette as we know it, Alcoa Aluminum, and then Duke Power, which is now Duke Energy, which operates in seven states. Fabulously wealthy. She inherited, I think at the age of 10 or 12 when her father died, $55 million. You can multiply that times eight. Oh, no, it's vastly more than that because eight is 1966. So this is in the 20s, you can imagine. By 1966, she was making $1 million a week in interest on her money. She could stand in the corner of a room and do nothing. And a week later, she'd be $1 million richer. So she was had five different, a Park Avenue apartment in four estates. Duke Farms in New Jersey, 2,500-acre estate, Shangri-La in Hawaii, this beautiful Islamic-themed estate in Diamond Head, the old Valentino place in Bel Air, L.A., Falcon Lair, and of course, Rough Point in Newport, Rhode Island, which is at the end of Bellevue Avenue, known as Millionaire's Row, and just around the corner, the Ocean Drive begins. And on the early evening of October 7th, 1966, she killed her longtime designer and art curator who'd worked for her for 7 years, Eduardo Torella. He was a Renaissance man. I found out as I told his story for the book, he was a war hero. He won the Bronze Star in the Battle of the Bulge. She never bought a work of art without him appraising it. Much of the art that's in Rough Point in that 7 year period prior, he curated. But he wanted to leave her for many reasons. She was notoriously stingy. She was a very tough person to work for. And his Hollywood career was amping up. He happened to be gay, and his partner, Edmund Carrow, was a well-known sculptor on the West Coast. But more importantly, he began to get into designing for films. And one of his closest friends, ironically, was Sharon Tate, very close to Kim Novak, and Marty Rantzehoff, this producer who discovered Sharon Tate, was enamored by him. So he designed one movie called Eye of the Devil that Sharon was in and David Niven, and then the big movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, the third film they had done, second film after Cleopatra, called The Sandpiper, which took place in Big Sur up in California, where Edmund and Eduardo had a house. So anyway, the last year of his life, he was 42 years old. He made the equivalent of $43,000, which is the equivalent today of almost $350,000. So his career was taking off. He designed another film that Sharon Tate was in called Don't Make Waves, and he was just flying. He was just, in fact, he was the one that convinced Marty Rantzehoff to use this legendary restaurant called Nepenthe as a major plot piece in the movie. And Charles Bronson, like Liz Taylor in the movie, you can believe it, plays like a bohemian painter with his, what they call a shack, but it's like this incredible, like Malibu-like palace over the cliffs, and Eduardo designed it. And his partner, Edmund, carved the naked bust of Liz that's a plot point in the film. Burton was only able to be in the country for 25 days for tax reasons, so they recreated the entire Nepenthe in Paris. And Eduardo had a little cameo in the film. So he was on the verge of fame and fortune. And he always had stars in his eye. Started as a song and dance man. Then started designing hats, like in clothing, costumes for Mae West. then eventually moved to L.A., designed hats for Hedda Hopper, Luella Parsons, the Gossip Doyens, and then he started doing houses. He did Peggy Lee's house, and he was just starting to fly when he moved into, got into feature film. So on the night before the rest of his life, he tells Doris Duke, literally minutes before she killed him, that he intended to leave her for good. And literally minutes later, one of the servants that I interviewed, or the like a part of the staff, told me they had a wicked fight, in Rhode Island terms, you know, using the great Rhode Island adjective. They had a wicked fight. And then shortly thereafter, he had asked her to rent a station wagon. It happened to be a brand new 1966 Dodge Polaro wagon, 2 tons. He told her that he needed it because he wanted to move his paintings. He had a number of paintings and things because he had a resident in each of her states. He wanted to move them down to New Jersey. Now, he didn't tell her that he was leaving. In fact, his friends warned her because Doris was known to be not just jealous but hyper-violent. For example, her common-law husband, Joe Castro, Mexican-American jazz musician, brilliant man, made a crack at one point about her piano playing. She ran into the kitchen, grabbed a butcher knife, slashed his arm, 150 stitches. So he sued her in L.A. for both assault and battery to confirm the common law marriage and for alimony. And he was literally, this is to give you an idea of the way Doris rolled and the tactics that she used to get out of trouble, was she had an ex-FBI agent in Hawaii more or less Shanghai him, kidnap him off the streets, hold him incommunicado at Shangri-La until he basically, they talked him into renouncing his L.A. lawyer and also giving up the suit. And he did. So then he came back to Doris for a while, and then she threw him out again. They had a roller coaster ride that was fueled by booze and barbiturates and other things. But so obviously she's a woman capable of violence. Another lover of hers, Leon Amar, told Stephanie Mansfield, a major biographer, that one night at dinner she threw a full bottle of wine at him, hit him in the head, and almost killed him. So, you know, she was a volatile figure and incredibly jealous. She was a Scorpio. And so literally, he tells her this, and they start fighting. And then, so they're going out to pick up this thing called the Reliquary of St. Ursula, which was a bust of a famous European saint that had in its chest a little relic, a bone, which is kind of a strange thing in the Catholic Church, but as a defrocked altar boy, I can vouch for that kind of fascination. And so this was a very valuable piece. She bought it the year before. She had Ade Bethune, who's a very well-known Belgian emigre who worked in Newport. She restored it over a year, but she wouldn't take possession or pay for it in full until Eduardo gave it his imprimatur. So that's where they were going that night, to an antique shop on Franklin Street to get it. So they're driving out of the estate. Eduardo is in the driver's seat. She's in the passenger seat. He gets out, and they park 15 feet from these massive iron gates, 12 feet high, 7 feet wide, 15 feet, more than enough room to open the gates. He doesn't even have a chance to open them when she does 4 affirmative acts. She slides over, act number 1, behind the wheel. Act number 2, she disengages the parking brake, which had to be done by hand. Number 3, she throws it into drive. And number 4, she guns the accelerator, spinning the tires and causing like 1.5 to 2 inch tire wide gouge marks in the gravel. Suddenly, the car goes forward, and I'm going to just tell you what really happened because you'll read the book. And this theory of what happened was documented by Fred Newton, the chief accident investigator of the Newport Police, but it was covered up at the time. Later, he became the chief of police himself, and a friend of mine, a police detective from New York, James Moss, said to me, you know, I'll bet he kept that, the truth of it, like a golden ticket in his pocket. And not that Fred wasn't competent to be chief, but he became chief. But that at that moment, what he said was Eduardo went up on the hood of the car, which is a thing people do, actually. When cars approach to save their lives, your brain, your kind of lizard brain triggers, and you jump up on the hood. So he's staring at her through the windshield of this vehicle in terror. And then she blows through the gates, bending these massive gates. There was a metal stop and a escutcheon plate at the top to keep them in. Several baluster rungs knocked out of the bottom. And then she hesitates for a moment. She hits the brakes. And he rolls off onto Bellevue Avenue. And how many seconds went by, and she's starting to roll the odds in her head. 1,001, 1,002. I can't get into her head, but did she think, I got away with the Castro stabbing? And then she just decided to commit, and she just hit the gas and dragged him to his death. And when she dragged him across Bellevue Avenue, he went up on the curb. She knocked down 20 feet of post and rail fence on the Laurel Lauder State, and with such force that the car ended up hitting a tree and ending up parallel to Bellevue, and he was dead. Within 96 hours, the police wrapped it up, called it an unfortunate accident. Yeah. She was the only living witness, and the police took that part of the up on the hood element out of the police report, because otherwise they would have had to put the bracelets on her that night, right, you know, lock her up. But she began giving money to Newport, thousands of dollars. She was hidden away in Newport Hospital the night of, so the Rhode Island investigators could not talk to her. And eventually she began restoring more than 70 colonial houses and literally helped Newport to avoid bankruptcy when the Navy pulled out in 73 and basically created the beautiful city that we see here today. So you could ask yourself, in the moral compass, I don't even mean to bring it up, is the life of one man worth what she did for the city? I say no, personally. Yeah, it's not worth killing somebody for any reason, okay? Especially violently, and especially a man who was so loyal to her over the years, who treated the staff beautifully, who was just a wonderful person and a war hero. But that's what I document in this book.
And in the book, you really raise a lot of very specific investigatory pieces that you've uncovered, and really the most, I guess, valuable portion of that is how you literally speak to people who either anecdotally, through family connections, or even through their own experience, have information about what really happened that night. So there's some new information in that regard that is something that we haven't talked about yet.
You're the first person that's going to be making it public, and I have to keep it closely held because I talked to my editor at Vanity Fair, and you know, we're considering doing something about it. But I was here Saturday night. First of all, I want to talk about the Breton Hotel, what a wonderful place it is. And they created what they call Artists in Residence, or Author in Residence thing for me this summer, where they're putting the copies of the books in all the rooms. And they basically, you know, people want them signed, they can come down. And I do these little seminars for a couple of hours every week, if not more, if the demand is such. So people can buy the book. So on Saturday I was doing, because it was rainy, I did kind of an extra one on Saturday. This gentleman came, and he came to me and he said, I was the paper boy for Doris Duke, and not only is your book 100% dead on in terms of what I just described with the, you know, the death of Torella up on the hood, crushing him and everything, but he said, I was there, I heard the lead up to it, I was riding my bike, finishing my route, coming from Ledge Road right up to the corner of Bellevue, I delivered the paper, but then he said he turned and saw Doris, not in shock, outside the car, not like, oh my God, what have I done, but standing very deliberately and looking under the car and kind of like this. So he came up behind her and said, ma'am, can I help you? I mean, she three times she said, you get the hell out of here. And each time she said it, like one second time he said, do you want me to go up to the house to call some? Get the hell out. And then the third time he said, do you want me to call the police? Get the hell out. And she's like ferociously yelling at this kid. He's 13 years old. So he goes home, basically finishes his route. And as he's doing that, he hears a police car arriving. Okay? Next day, he gets the Daily News. He has to deliver it. And he sees, so he goes to his dad, Dad, you know, this is what happened. Because he didn't see a man under the car, and he heard a man yelling earlier. He heard a man and a woman arguing. Yeah. It was about 50 yards away as the crow flies on the corner of Ledge Road, and he kept pedaling closer, and the voices got louder as he got closer, okay? And then he literally, after the crash, turns the corner, and he sees her, and then he walks up behind her, literally as close as we are now, and that's when he said she ghosted me. She kept walking back and forth like this so I couldn't get a good look under the car. And then that's when he put it together the next day when it says she kills her friend Torella. Dad, he goes to his dad, and his father basically says, you will tell this to no one, your brothers, your sisters, your mother, not one of your friends. I don't want you to ever hear this again. And he was crushed because his father was a very righteous person who always did the right thing. Years later, when he was old enough to really challenge his father, His father said, listen, this woman was capable of anything, and I didn't want you on your bike one night to get hit from behind and lose his son.
That's
and
nuts.
Only then, when he learned, that he was he able to kind of accept it. But right around that time, he enlisted in the Marines and went to Vietnam, and two of his buddies he told the story to. He finally opened up, and then when he got back, he told it to at least five close friends in Newport, and they're all contemporaneous. You know, these are all people that, you know, have, you can reach them, you can call them and talk to them and find out is what's the story consistent. It's not unlike what we see with the Me Too movement, where women felt abused years ago and nobody believes them, and now, you know, they, but if you can prove that you had told the story back then in depth, it has, it lends credibility to this, to the account. So that's all I can say right now. I'm still working the story, but if it's true, and I believe it is, I believe this, he's one of the most credible sources I've ever met. And you know, as an investigative reporter, you come upon the everybody, and a lot of, there are a lot of pretenders and fakers out there, and but this guy, I mean, if I was a lawyer and I was prosecuting a case, I have a law degree on, but I never practiced, I would put him on the stand. That's how solid this guy is to me. But I still have to run down all these other avenues to nail it down. But if it's true, it is the, he's the first and only living witness to supply fresh, new, and direct evidence of what happened that night. Because all of the, as Bill alluded to, there are many people like Officer Eddie Angel, the first officer on the scene. He was incredibly valuable. There, Norman Mather, another officer who was told by Chief Radice when he arrived, go back and write it up, Mather. Yeah. And then he walked arm in arm with Doris Radice, the chief, into Rough Point, where apparently some kind of an arrangement was made. So then when Mather's typing up the what he, you know, he, they somebody rips the triplicate form out of the typewriter and throws it in the garbage, because then it was cover-up mode. And I'll say the last thing, of course it won't be the last thing I say, but one of the things that is the most startling to me, and the most proof of, can I borrow this book? The most proof of the collusion between Doris Duke and the Newport police in letting her get away with murder is chapter 7. And what happened was, this happened on a Friday night, okay? And the, so immediately Doris was, you know, taken to Newport Hospital, and the medical examiner, Dr. McAllister, who happened to be my family physician growing up, which shocked me when I learned this, he allowed himself to be hired as her private doctor that night and put her in a private room at Newport Hospital so the state investigators couldn't get to him. Well, then on she came home the next day. They wouldn't let the guys talk to her then at Rough Point. Sunday, she's in her bedroom, and cue the dog. There were two German shepherds on either side of her bed, right? You know, they sounded a little more ferocious than that little dog. So anyway, so her lawyer was there, her business manager, and these poor guys, Al Mazzarone, now departed, but Louis Parati, who I talked to, is still alive. He said to me, by the time we got there, Peter, the fix was in. And this is, on the basis of this single little interview of four questions right here, they closed the case. But then Radice took a lot of flack from the Attorney General, Nugent, so he dialed it back. So on, after he'd already said to the UPI and the AP and the New York Times, did it fall out?
No. That, I think that...
It's on the verge of falling out.
No, okay. This is going to be for you.
No, that's okay. So anyway, on the after they came out with this death of Miss Duke's friend rated unfortunate accident, he dialed it back and he asked the police to come up with a, you got to help me close out this case. And they fabricated a transcript. They literally created a phony three-page transcript of a supposed interrogation the next day. And we know it's phony. Why? Because the first question they ask is, it says, interrogation of Doris Duke by Captain Paul Sullivan at Rough Point, 12:30 p.m., Tuesday, October 11th. And then it says, Miss Duke, what is your full name, age, and date of birth and residence? Answer, Doris Duke, 53, November 22nd, 1928, Rough Point, Bellevue Avenue, Newport, Rhode Island. Well, she crossed out, they got her date of birth wrong. They made her younger. So she crossed out and wrote 1912 DD and initialed it. Well, if that was a real interview in real time with a real stenographer, she would have corrected it on the spot.
Right.
And stenographer. So that is proof positive, prima facie evidence of a fabrication. But after that, the case was closed, and that was it. Then she forced the Torella family to sue for wrongful death. She dragged the case out for 5 years. They offered as little as $200,000 for settlement. She refused. And then finally, she was found civilly liable during the liability phase. But when they got to the damage phase, her lawyer so denigrated Eduardo, who was gay. A gay man in 1966, you know, was not a full man. And I'm not saying that. It's just the sad reality of life. And so the damage award was $75,000. And when her lawyers took their cut, each of his five brothers and three sisters got $5,620.
Isn't that awful?
Which is, to me, that is part of what drove me forward to tell the story as much as finding out the truth behind the death itself.
Yeah, and that's when you step in years later and this Vanity Fair piece is published. It explodes. The book comes out. It also explodes. We start doing these podcasts. They start getting passed around, at least regionally.
Yeah,
and
right.
Now this narrative has changed. In these last minutes here, a couple of things. Number one, the changes at the Newport Restoration Foundation in terms of their decision of how to categorize what happened on that night. And then also being on the ground here in Newport and some of the folks in the room right now, what you've encountered.
Well, and one in particular, which we'll talk to in a minute. Well, first of all, Rough Point is a $75 million nonprofit. I mean, the Newport Restoration Foundation, which still owns and manages these. She never sold these houses. She just rents them. So they get about, I think it's $5 million a year in rental income, another $5 from the $2 billion Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. Now, this is my memory from looking at their last tax filing as of July of 2019. But they only gave away, so they're $75 million, they only gave away $11,800 that year, you know, and so, you know, I said when my book came out, or R.J. Heim of WJR lovingly did a four-part series on the book, and he wanted to get their reaction to my findings. And they said, we don't have the wherewithal to investigate Peter Lance's findings, so we're just going to go with the accident theory. Well, what they did was actually, starting in April of 2019, they have an exhibit space up at the second floor of Rough Point. It's a great tour, and I encourage all of you to take it. And I'm hearing from people that since the Vanity Fair piece and this, you know, you can only imagine the fascination has increased the visitors, which bully for them. But what they normally change the exhibit every year. Well, in April of 2019, they knew that I was going to have this piece. We thought Vanity Fair was going to go in the summer of 2019. So they did what I would call a William Barr, what he did with the Mueller report, the AG. They got ahead of it, and they created this wall-size exhibit called The Accident at Rough Point, had five material misstatements of fact, including the utterly false statement that she settled with Torella's family during that trial. I mean, that's outrageous, because she didn't, you know? So the point is, Donna Lohmeyer, the niece of Eduardo, wrote a letter to Mark Thompson, the executive director, and then I wrote a letter to him, and finally, grudgingly, after Sean Flynn covered it in the Daily News multiple times, and the Advocate, which is a major LGBTQ+ publication, they have been really supportive of me, Diane Anderson Minshall, the CEO. After they covered it, then they changed accident to incident in the title, and they cut that last paragraph. But they're still trying to defend her. They're still saying, like, Doris was unfamiliar with the transmission. And yet, remember that little three-page transcript I just mentioned? They ask her in the transcript, have you ever driven the car? Oh, yeah, I drove it twice that day. I picked up Eduardo at the airport. She wasn't unfamiliar with the transmission. Okay? So the point is, why do they continue to perpetuate this? They should take a roller with the appropriate color paint in that exhibit hall and just cover it. And I say that only because they're in the business of history, historical preservation, right?
Right.
And, you know, Michael Henry Adams is a distinguished historian. He just told me he's coming to Newport next week. I can't wait to bring him here. And he lives in Harlem. He's one of the top historians of the Harlem Renaissance. He's an amazing guy. And he said to me, you know, when Thomas Jefferson, for 150 years, he's the father of our country. He's one of my great heroes, Jefferson. But on the other hand, he fathered six slaves by Sally Hemings. For 150 years, the established historians of this country and the rest of the world denied that. Oh, no, that can't be. And then a really distinguished historian in 1997 proved it. Not one, but six children by Sally Hemings. And now it's at Monticello. They admit it. They have an exhibit. They have finally adjusted to the truth. Why can't the Newport Newport Restoration Foundation do that? Is that not a fair question to my wonderful assembled audience here and behind me? You know, it's like, I just think, what do they... Now, and what, there's one other thing I brought up to them, and I heard crickets. I talked to their lawyers in Providence. I said, you know what you guys should do? You're $75 million a year. The top five executives made $750,000 in salaries and bonuses, which 10% of their net worth. Why don't, and you only gave away $11,800. Why don't you set up a scholarship in the name of Eduardo Torella to Rhode Island School of Design? And I'm saying it here for the state of Rhode Island to hear for the first time. Set up a scholarship in perpetuity every year for a deserving student, male or female, first from Newport County, and if we don't find one there, the entire state of Rhode Island, to one of the best design schools in the world, in the name of Eduardo Torella. Would that not begin to pay it back a little bit? And haven't heard a word on that, but I'm not going to give up on that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Boy, that would move mountains for sure and be everlasting. It would outlive all of us.
Exactly, and give opportunities to dreamers like him.
Right, exactly. And that's what was cut short. That's the real tragedy of this whole story, is that it was the eve of his new life.
Exactly.
And that's
Shakespearean.
Shakespearean, exactly. We've got a gentleman here who has joined us, and I guess let's start with a little introduction and who you are and what you bring to the table, this fancy table they have here at the Brand Hotel.
Well, I begin by saying that I borrowed the book from my cousin who had borrowed it from someone else, and I got to page 122 and I said, this won't work. I've got to own the book. So I went to, and this is a plug, Island Books, and paid $31.99 plus tax for that book, and now it's mine. No one can get it from me. And through the generosity of Peter Lance, he bought another book and inscribed it so that if I loan it out to someone with my name and address in it, I'm bound to get it back so that it can make a circle. I'm sorry, you're losing business.
It's all right. Somebody at the Ancient Order of Hibernians told me he gave 9 people the book. I said, so don't worry about it. Yeah, but okay. Keep talking. You reached out to me over the weekend. It was one of the most heartwarming emails I ever got. And could you tell, first of all, you're 93 years young, yes?
Is that yes,
true?
I am.
And he's so, look how spry this man is. I mean, he's like...
Is he telling his first fib? I don't believe it. Right?
Okay. So anyway, but he... Yes. If you don't mind telling what you told me in the email about this friend of yours who went to your church, yes, and that night, the night of when she was secreted away in a room at Newport Hospital.
Yes. This is what I call the sidebar, told to me when I was on parking lot duty for St. Paul's United Methodist Church on Marlboro Street. 3 of us. The female who was the nurse, John Jennings, who was another other part of the trio, uh-huh, and myself, uh-huh, and I was telling them that I'm reading the book, and when I mentioned Dr. Matt McAllister, she said, I know him. I was on duty that night. Okay. But as a nurse, she had to get vital signs, but he forbid any entrance to that room.
Right.
Now, she's in one of the two ICU rooms on the floor. Later in the evening, she sees smoke coming from under the door.
Oh, yeah.
There's oxygen on this floor.
Right, right.
But I can't go in there to see what it is. So she goes to the Newport Hospital authorities and says what she found. And they came up there, and they went into that room, and when they opened the door, it was loaded with burning candles, and the explanation from Doris Duke was, I'm mourning the death of my best friend, Eduardo. Well, I don't know what... Anyway,
they extinguished. But that story, you told me that, and then I met the paper boy a little later that day.
Yes.
And what the paper boy's account of her is so chilling and cold-blooded in terms of the way she reacted. And then she gets back in the car, and it almost seems that, because she had no marks on her face, she gets back in the car, and then when Eddie Angel gets there and this Navy nurse I interviewed to arrive, she is has bruises, what Bill Watterson called steering wheel injuries on her face. Like, did she bang herself? She's creating an empathy. Then she gets out and starts wandering like she's in shock and runs into Rough Point. I believe this had to be part of that same scheme. In other words, she had to send to Rough Point to get those candles. They don't have candles in Newport Hospital. If it was a church, maybe. You might have some little votive candles. But so that meant that, again, the elaborate lengths she went to, right, to sell the story of her distraught feelings that night. Anyway, what a wonderful contribution to the historical record.
Absolutely. Let's give it up. I guess let's wrap this portion. And for anyone who, of course, the book is available. Of course, Vanity Fair article is available. What was it, July, August
issue. They also have it for sale here at the hotel tonight, and I will sign it. If you get one, I'll sign it for you. So, whoever.
And you can also listen to two other conversations that Peter and I have had during the last year at ripodcast.com. You'll be able to find the first one we went on for, I mean, a while. It's like a 2-hour conversation, and it exploded as far as listenership. It's a really engaging listen, so you did a great job of laying out in more detail exactly what's happening. But I guess in closing here, how important is it? Because there's a lot of talk these days about understanding history. Some of it's race-related, some of it's just other misinterpretations that have happened. How important is it for people to assess the type of work that you're doing? Not necessarily how important is it for you to do it, but for people on the outside to take the time to better understand even minutia and the impact that it has in terms of accurate history, at least that which we're able to prove, like you have here.
Well, I think that if you, first of all, murder is murder is murder. There's no nuance to it. You know, you can't be explained away. Now, there are degrees of murder, right? There's manslaughter, there's which the sliding scale, as I talk about in the book, is like, you know, just, you know, an accident where you're not intoxicated, but somebody runs out, you hit them, they die. That's manslaughter, but it's your culpability is minimum. The more you go toward drinking and driving and the... But once you get over to cross over into the territory of intentional murder, that's why it's the capital crime. That's why there's no statute of limitations on murder. And even though Doris Duke herself has died in 1993, I think that the historical record should reflect, and the legal record should reflect, what happened. And it's just important for history. We need to know if Thomas Jefferson is the father of six enslaved people. That's an important part of our history. It doesn't take away from, we hold a few truths to be self-evident, all the great work that he did over back then as a founding father, but it gives us an understanding and perspective. The movement for racial justice is so important. And in this city of Newport, Rhode Island, it's such a small town, one of the most unique on earth. I think it's important, and you might ask the people that came here tonight whether they agree with me, that this truth needs to come out, and the Restoration Foundation needs to face it. I challenge Mark Thompson, the executive director, to go on your program with me and tell me where I'm wrong in the book. You know, I had a couple of minor factual errors, like Taylor and Burton's film after they did Cleopatra was the VIPs, not the yellow Rolls Royce. You know, I had a few things like that. But other than that, and other than typos, I think the book has stood the test of time. The Vanity Fair piece is now going to be a year old next week. No one has come forward and said that I was anything significant wrong at all, not even significantly wrong. So I just challenge the Newport Restoration Foundation to do the right thing. They should set up that scholarship. And you know what they should do? Across the street, there's a lamppost and a fence that obscures the death. There should be a little plaque. Mm-hmm. There should be something that with Eduardo's name on Bellevue Avenue that says this is where he died that night.
I was working at the hospital when they had the cold. But we didn't pay it any mind because they have codes all the time.
Yeah.
And somebody said, oh, Doris Duke had an accident. We're still not giving it any first thought because we just figured, oh, she was in an accident and that's it. And we didn't know until the next day when we read the paper what had happened. And it was a shock. Yeah, it really was.
Peter Lance, ladies and gentlemen, Homicide of Rough Point.
Rhode Island's podcast of record, B-Town. At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.